Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at winbridge.org. Our guest tonight is J.R. Archer, and this show has been pre-recorded, so we will be unable to take any live call-ins tonight. So I want to start the evening off with a few of the updates for Forever Family Foundation events and happenings. We want to remind everybody to always check the events page on our website regularly for all information on our events and announcements at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. All reservations and information can be taken care of while you're on the website. Our September webinar, The Telepathy Project with Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell, that was scheduled for September 13th at 9 p.m. Eastern, has been postponed until September 27th. Those who have already registered for the event have been sent notices with the new date and login instructions. We know that there was a waiting list for those who were closed out of the annual grief retreat this past July in Chester, Connecticut. And while our upcoming winter grief retreat in warm and beautiful Florida is not until this coming January 5th through 7th, that too is now almost half filled. We do caution those interested in attending to keep in mind that we do have a no-refund policy before you book. Each year, 50 guests come from across the globe to spend an all-inclusive weekend with like-minded people in a variety of activities and small breakout workshops, all designed to heal. The weekend features spirit communication with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Joseph Scheel, Janet Nohavik, and Doreen Malloy, who will all be working alongside Dr. Mo Hanna and the rest of our professional staff. We also have a fabulous New York event set for Sunday, October 29th, the Afterlife Luncheon is a five-hour event that includes a scrumptious lunch. Join us as New York Times bestselling author Leslie Kane, author of Surviving Death, a journalist investigates evidence for an afterlife, and she will be joined by extraordinary medium Laura Lynn Jackson, author of her New York Times bestseller, The Light Between Us, Stories from Heaven, Lessons for the Living. It's a compelling afternoon of learning and spirit communication. Reservations for this event have been steady, so you might want to reserve your seat as soon as you begin thinking about attending. Our Holidays Past raffle drawing is set for December 23rd, so please help us out and buy some raffles, lots of raffles, to win as many as five readings with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Renata Santarelli, Renee Buck, Eliza Ray, Catherine Nadal, and Neil Sapowski. It's only $5 to enter. And please, please, please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great nonprofits. Lastly, if you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at businessmembership@foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Back to you, Bob.
And we have, as you mentioned, a great guest tonight, J.R. Archer. So let's get right into it. Now, John Beecher, who I know, he uses the pen name of J.R. Archer, was formerly the CEO of an independent record company. And as such, he was attached to all of the material trappings that comes along with financial success. An experience back in 2000 changed everything for him, and he plotted a new course for his life. He later founded White Crow Books, which has published, I would imagine, at this point, somewhere around 175 books. But the interesting thing is that they all deal with spiritual themes. But now John is an author himself, and his new book is called A Dog's View of Love, Life, and Death. Welcome to Signs of Life, John.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me on. It's very kind of you.
It's our pleasure. So I mentioned the book, A Dog's View of Life, Love, Life, and Death. And it's a novel, but it contains an abundance of spiritual concepts and evidence of life after death. So I was curious, I mean, were you always on a search for a greater reality, or did this interest come about later in life?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't on a search at all, really. I think it found me. Really, I was. I think I spent the first 44 years of my life almost as a sort of happy atheist. And you know, I grew up with my mother and my stepfather in a kind of not an anti-religious household, but a non-religious household. You know, and I was in the music business, flying around the world and doing all the stuff that we do in the music business and having a good time sometimes and other times not so good, but generally good. And then one night after we went out for dinner on a pre-christening, a friend of mine was having their child was getting christened, and my wife at the time was the godmother, and we went out to the party. We were drinking a lot, but you know, I drank a lot before, and I went to bed. We had all these guests staying the night, Americans, funny enough, I went to bed, locked up the house, went to bed, and the next thing I know, I was laying in my wife was talking to me, and she was saying, John, you're in trouble. And I'm thinking, I'm looking up the ceiling, I'm thinking, I don't feel like I'm in trouble. You know, I went to bed, I went to sleep, I was fine. And cut a long story short, in my sleep, she'd heard a little bang or something, and I'd obviously got up and fallen over in my sleep or something. And I think I fell over on a carpeted floor on my face, like in those Charlie Chaplin movies or Laurel and Hardy, where they go straight down without, so I was like asleep or something. And I smashed all my face up, severed my lip, I had 30 stitches in my lip, my teeth were knocked out, my front teeth, my jaw was broken on both sides. I was a real mess. I didn't feel anything, interestingly. So I went to hospital and I was stitched up and I had to have my mouth all wired up, and I had to have my jaw wired up, if you see what I mean. I had to have 6 weeks off work because I was told not to talk. And in that kind of business, we talk a lot, you know. So, and during that time, I started writing a journal because I had not much to do anyway. So what I noticed, it took me a while, and because I was writing things down and everything, after that event, I felt very differently. But I didn't really associate it with the event, if you see what I mean. So there I am, you know, all of a sudden I've been running this business, I've been doing okay, and I've been, you know, living life, got children, you know, been married twice, that kind of thing. But I'm feeling very differently. So to give you an example, one of the early things I noticed within, let's say, 6 months or something of this happening is that I used to shoot a lot. I used to shoot game. We have here in England, they shoot game in the winter, and birds and pheasants and things like that. And I had shooting booked up in the winter, and my pal called me up after I'd sort of healed up. This happened in October, so it would have been about Christmas time. I've healed up, and I've got some shooting days booked all over the country. And he phones me, and he called me, and he said, are you ready? We're going shooting next week for a day. And I said, oh, I can't shoot anything. And he said, what do you mean you can't shoot anything? I said, I couldn't possibly kill an animal. He said, why not? He said, you've been killing him for years. And I said, well, I can't explain it. I just can't do that anymore. I said, I couldn't even kill a fly anymore. So that was kind of weird, because I didn't really understand why I was feeling that myself. I didn't really understand it. So I didn't connect anything to this accident. But, you know, I also noticed over that year that I kind of lost interest in my business, really, which was my whole life. I mean, it was a good time. Not lost interest. I wasn't depressed or anything. But I certainly, you know, the idea of sports cars and all this kind of thing, it all seemed a bit trivial. And over the next couple of years, a lot changed. I walked out of my career. I got divorced. I became a vegetarian. I took up voluntary work. I was feeling very differently. I had no fear of death anymore. I had not that I really thought about it before, but it was a sort of a plugged-in feeling, let's just say. I mean, I suppose what I'm saying is I read years later about people who have near-death experiences and that kind of thing, and the common after effects that they feel. And I didn't even know what a near-death experience was, and I'm not sure I was near death or anything, and I have no memory of any of this, but I certainly have. I could tick all those boxes that so many people report.
Yeah, well, it's real interesting because certainly, although you didn't have a classic near-death experience, you certainly experienced many of the after effects, as you mentioned, that were life-changing for you. So we're going to go to a short break. When we come back, we're going to get right into the book, A Dog's View of Love, Life, and Death. Stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Windbridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums, we are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a Windbridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more.
Am I Psychic is a mobile app designed using statistics, science, and parapsychological protocols to test psychic ability using fun games. Each game has two unique modes. In psychokinesis mode, influence the game using mind over matter ability. In extrasensory perception mode, guess which random option will be chosen. Am I Psychic can store your results in an anonymous database used to eventually publish in academic journals. Available on the App Store and Google Play. Go to ampsychicapp.com and be a part of proving psychic phenomena to the world. Some profits will be donated to the Rhine Research Center.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net. Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is J.R. Archer. Our sponsor is the Windbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at windbridge.org. Bob?
And the book is A Dog's View of Love, Life, and Death. And John, I know you, of course, we mentioned that the book is written in novel form, but it's clear that you've taken much of the content from your own experience and your own thoughts. The characters in the story, the ones that are the main players are the dogs, you know, who exhibit incredible wisdom, and they communicate telepathically, and not only with other dogs, but with their human friends too. You know, we hear so often from people that they're convinced that their dogs and their cats have some telepathic ability. Was that something that you always wondered about?
Not really. I mean, I'll give you a little bit of background. What happened? I hadn't had dogs since my children were young, 30 years ago or something. And then about in the last 3 years, both my parents had strokes, and they're both alive but incapacitated. And I had a sort of an agreement with them years ago that if anything happened to them, I'd take their dogs. So here I am, suddenly I've got these two dogs last year. And of course, I've always had, you know, you hear stories about, you know, you notice dogs, they know when you're coming home before you get home, you know, they even before the car arrives, they, and things like that, and that kind of thing. And so, but what happened was, so there I am, you know, living by the sea on the south coast of England last year, and I've got these two little dogs, little terrier crosses, Rosie and Rags, my parents' dogs. And one of them just looks at me all the time. She looks at me all the time. And I was saying to my girlfriend, I said, you know, this dog knows more than it's letting on. And one day I take him for a walk every day on the beach. And one day I was just standing on the beach waiting for while they were doing their thing, if you see what I mean. And an idea came into my head. And it was just an idea. It was just an idea about dogs knowing more than we think they know. It was a story idea. I never thought about it before. I never thought about writing a book before. As you know, I published nonfiction books, but I've never thought about writing a book myself. Never thought I could. And I certainly never thought about writing a novel, not for a second. And anyway, but this idea came into my head. And then a scene came into my head, this guy jumping off the top of a building, a guy called Robbie. And Robbie was a real person who was a friend of mine who did jump off a building, unfortunately, and killed himself. So I had this idea, this just came to mind literally in a minute. And I went home and I wrote it down, which is also something I'd never done.
Well, you know, a lot of the things people will be able to relate to. I know one of the characters in the book actually, you know, had a near-death experience, and she was trying to explain it to her psychologist friend. You can certainly make the connection where so many people who have such experiences actually do go to mental health professionals, and they usually get not taken seriously. I mean, people don't understand these things. I guess, you know, that was one of the points you were trying to make.
Yes, I think that's true. I think what happened was I obviously had a lot of ideas in my mind, having had a lot of experiences. Having had this kind of experience myself, and then because I didn't kind of believe the experience I'd had, I didn't really understand it. I then spent the next 10 years validating. I was, you know, sitting with mediums. I met those remote viewing guys over in Las Vegas. I went to Robert Munro's workshops. I made a documentary with Gary Schwartz. I did all this stuff trying to just validate how I was feeling. And so I suppose I had lots of pent up ideas in there. And the book is really, I'm using the dogs to express ideas that you probably regularly speak about on this show.
Yeah. I tell you, John, one of the great lines in the book where, you know, two of the dogs are communicating with each other. I guess it was Rosie and one of the other dogs. And one says, well, we love all humans, but they do dumb things. I'm so amazed that they live so long. I guess we do, from your experience, we do a lot of dumb things when life gets in the way of our true nature, don't we?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, really, the book came together quite quickly. It came together because I was expressing kind of ideas, and the ideas, if you like, you know, about life after death and near death experiences and all this kind of thing were kind of more important than the story. So the story revolved around the idea that there wasn't some great big plot. There were just these sort of humans, many of very recognized from people I know and from myself and others and things like that, just moving through life, making big mistakes and doing all sorts of things. And you've got these sort of dogs representing, well, some of the dogs representing some enlightened beings, consciously knowing more than we know, thinking, you know, what's the matter with these people? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think another overriding theme, you know, in the novel is that, you know, the dogs just experience, you know, and you know, perhaps we should learn a lesson from that, maybe experiencing more and judging less.
Absolutely. And I think the important thing about the dogs, when they're communicating with each other, they're talking about the idea that they have immortality, let's say, or spiritual beings without, in residing in a physical body. To them, it's just kind of normal. So they talk about dropping their bodies, and when they die, they don't see death as anything particularly problematical at all. And so they're surprised that humans do. They're surprised.
Yeah, and I know, as the novel evolves, it becomes clear that there are certain entities, whether they're in the form of dogs or you want to call them angels, that appear to guide us to evolve our consciousness. Personally, do you think that we all have helpers from other realms that guide us through our physical lives?
Well, I don't know whether you have these, but I have enormous amounts of synchronicities, and I have done for a long time. But since I began to appreciate them, I have more of them. And you kind of try and work out, how does that work? I mean, they obviously happen. You must have had plenty of people on your show who have fantastic synchronicities, and therefore, if you sit with various mediums and you have communications with people coming through, allegedly coming through with information. And you sort of think. I've sat with mental mediums and had outstanding kind of evidence from people. Things that I didn't even know, and I've reacted on it. I've done something as a result of it. And so I'm thinking, well, whether I'm being nudged at all or whether we are, but it certainly feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once you learn to open up to these things. And most people just ignore these synchronicities throughout their life and evidence and communications because it just doesn't fit into their realm of experience. But one of the advantages of learning and exploring is that you start to take note of these things that are happening from non-physical sources. So to that end, the writing a novel about these things, I think what I would commend you on is that it's written in a form that makes it palatable to people, because it's not threatening. It's not a research paper. But yet, it's chock full of concepts that we've been discussing. So I think you did an excellent job with it. Do you think, John, that at one time we, when I say we, I mean mankind, had this inherent intuitive ability? That's the way it was. But over time, it's been weaned out of us by our societal and educational and cultural influences. I mean, could we learn more by going back to our roots?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I mean, I have all sorts of ideas, and I've read a lot, as you probably have. And I remember a few years ago, I went to one of those remote viewing conferences, and I met Ingo Swann and Russell Targ, and anybody knows those people that ran that Stanford Research University program of remote viewing for years for the US government. And I remember I was there for 3 days and we did a test, and I had quite an interesting experience myself and all this sort of thing. And I remember thinking at the time, how is this evolution, this must be useful at some point. And is it possible that back in the day, back in the hunter-gatherer day, that people had this idea, that people had this, and we lost it, just like most people can't remember phone numbers anymore since they got their mobile phone and things like that. So I read a book by a guy called Brian English, who sat in the sort of library of the Society of Psychical Research. He was quite a well-known broadcaster here in the UK. And he was talking a lot about anthropology, and he was talking about back in the day when explorers were going to Africa and missionaries were coming back out, talking about how they'd educated savages and all this kind of thing. But they weren't. But really, they weren't really educating anybody. They were just trying to convert them to Christianity. And he talks about then about the idea when we were kids, we were growing up, we heard about tribes and smoke signals and all this kind of thing. And he talked about the idea that the smoke signal It wasn't a message or anything. Well, it was a message. They weren't communicating by smoke signal. What would happen was if someone went missing or something went missing, an animal or something, they would send up a smoke signal, and anybody that was in the vicinity would go into, if you like, a state like a remote viewing or trance state, whatever you want to call it, and focus on the missing person, animal, whatever it was, and invariably they'd find it, and they described the act of doing that. They called it opening the gates of eternity. Well, I don't know, that's the translation. And I always thought that was interesting because obviously, you know, all the religions and talk about eternity, this time, this, you know, the state of no time and all this sort of thing. And apparently, that I read very recently, that there are some scientists now looking at the idea of that we had Homo sensorium before, you know, the idea that we had this ability back in the hunter-gatherer days, but we lost it when we moved into the urban areas. It's easier to communicate with language rather than telepathically and hide and lie. Whereas, you know, before, if we were communicating telepathically, everything was open.
Yeah, this is something that we think of consciousness as evolving, but it's really, it may be just a matter of reverting back to what it once was.
Seems to be consciousness is always there, and we're sort of dipping in. We're either becoming expanded into it more.
Yeah.
Then it changing. We change, maybe, you know. But So there are lots of ideas, and there are lots of ideas in the book like that. This idea that we had this ability once and we've lost it.
And along the same theme, I mean, we're always people will constantly say that what they love about dogs is that the dogs show unconditional love no matter what. You know, they just have that overriding unconditional love, and perhaps it's the same. We're hardwired the same way as humans, but we just haven't realized it yet, you know. So using the dog,
that's a long way from there yet, doesn't it? sometimes, but I think it's true. I mean, to be honest, it was easy to use the dogs as vehicles, let's say, to express ideas, because dogs do, in some ways, they do exhibit unconditional love. They do exhibit all this. We sort of look at them and thinking, well, we could do that, but we don't. Why don't we do it? Because we don't seem to value it. But whenever you think about the idea of unconditional love, forgiveness, and all this kind of idea, it seems like a thing that should be a default position in the future sometime. But we're not quite there yet, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have another another dog character in the book who was once a racing greyhound, you know, now retired. And the greyhound was abused by his owner, as many dogs in that racing arena are. And this dog was being counseled, I think, by Rosie, who explained that what he went through was just another experience. You know, you can't judge it as either being good or bad. It was just an experience to add to all the others. When I read something like that, you know, I'm just putting myself in your, it's a novel, but these are things that you've obviously contemplated for a long time. I mean, do you try to live your life that way now? I mean, you know, do you try to, when something happens that may be bad, kind of stepping back from it and just look at it as part of a continuing series of experiences?
Well, I certainly got the hang of death, I believe, after I had this kind of experience, and I came to the conclusion, well, not conclusion, because it changes, our thoughts change as we go along, but if you get the hang of death, life becomes much more interesting. And if you get the hang of the idea that this is not all there is, and that this is just a very small part of our greater reality, life can become very interesting, and you don't worry about it. And whatever happens to you isn't really important. What's important is how you react to what happens to you. And so therefore, even supposedly catastrophic experiences, There are things we learn from them, and there are things that we, you know, hopefully, and obviously that's difficult depending on the situation, but it does make, I do feel like that, you know, when bad things happen or good things happen, I try not to think of them as too good or too bad. I tend to think of them as just experiences, and there's a reason why I'm learning them. Maybe I don't know what the reason is, But that's the sort of view I take these days.
Yeah. Well, it's a healthy view and one that to which we can all aspire. It's hard. You know, it's hard when something bad happens, to step back from it and look at it, because it has direct, physical effects on you or mental effects on you. So it's hard to put it in perspective, but I think we all, work towards that goal. And I think we would be much healthier when we are able to do that. One character in the book, which is really powerful, is an older man who's trapped in his own body. He's completely paralyzed, but yet, able to communicate telepathically and leave his broken body. So, when I read that, the overwhelming message there was that not only from him, but in the entire novel, is that we have to realize that we're much more than our physical bodies. Is that a fair assessment of where the novel was going?
I think so. I think the Seamus, he was a quadriplegic, and he was trapped in his body, and he thought that he thought there was nothing he could learn from life, even though he was in that situation. And maybe to a certain extent he was hanging on where he didn't need to hang. He didn't have to wish his life away, but he didn't wish to hang on. And I think Rosie, the dog, she basically helped him toward the end of his life and realized that whatever was happening to him, he was learning from it. And whilst he shouldn't be afraid of death and cling on to it, he should try and gain from every experience while he's here.
Mm. And as he was communicating with the dog, he was told that many dogs are able to put thoughts in a human's mind, but the human most often simply thinks it's, it's an original thought, certainly not from any outside influences, or from his subconscious. So I guess that's often the case when we talk about telepathy, either from a living or a deceased entity, that many of us refuse to even consider the fact that we can be influenced from other sources. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, certainly for me, before I had a head trauma, I wouldn't accept anything. I wouldn't accept anything like that. So, the interesting thing for me now is, I've sat with a number of mediums and read a lot of books and all this kind of stuff, and really to validate how I feel. But I can't. But I certainly believe that now. I was a complete, when I say atheist, I mean a materialist, I guess. I guess I was. And now I feel that I know. I have this knowing. I suppose that's what faith is, possibly. I don't know. But I have a knowing that death is nothing, and this is just an experience that I'm having here, albeit a very important one. But then at the same time, as I'm saying it, I realize that my rational brain says I don't know anything. And the mental institutions are full of people who think they know everything. So I wouldn't say I'm torn. So I feel very comfortable about saying I know, but at the same time, I don't think I know anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know much. It's a vast universe out there. We're talking with J.R. Archer, and the novel is called The Dog's View of Love, Life, and Death. It's not only an entertaining, novel, but has some deep messages that I think we all can learn from. We're going to take a short break. We're going to have a lot more with John to talk about, so stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Does consciousness survive death? Can technology be used to interact with the deceased? Can hearing from the dead heal the living? At the Windbridge Institute, we are working to answer these and similar questions. Through our studies with certified research mediums, we are examining psychic abilities and communication with the other side, offering insights into the limitless nature of consciousness and unlocking the possibilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Be a part of it. Become a Windbridge member today. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn more. The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.kamlak.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, our guest tonight is J.R. Archer. Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at winbridge.org. Bob?
And John, one of the main characters in a book at one point seeks out the services of a medium. Not during the reading, but in general conversation, she's told that sometimes people transition to another world not believing in life after death. So when what they experience when they cross over, since it doesn't fall into their realm of belief, but they sort of don't move on because they don't realize that they're dead. I mean, is that something that you personally believe? I know in the book the medium was part of a rescue circle, you know, where they would rescue souls that crossed over but that couldn't go further. So is that a concept that you ascribe to?
My kind of, I suppose, belief is a funny thing, isn't it? You have an experience, you sit down, you have evidence from various mediums or whatever happens, so you get what you call information that you couldn't get from it, that person couldn't possibly know. So you come to some conclusions. And then I read a lot and I publish books and I'm dealing with people or the authors who are various, whether they're priests or academics or the rest of it. So you come to some conclusions. It does appear, and it does appear from all the sort of, if you like, evidence that you get from these kind of communications, that you will struggle a bit for a while. If you firmly believe there's nothing there, there will be nothing there for a while, and you'll be, and you could be in a dream state for quite a, as we measure time, for a long period of time. That does seem to be the case from and maybe that's where the old ideas of hell come from, with, you know, with various religions and things like that. So I think there's something to that. Personally, if someone said to me, you know, what can advice? Not that I give advice, but what advice would you give someone who was dying? I say, have an open mind. Have an open mind.
That's good advice. That's all you could. It's good. It's a perfect way to counsel somebody. You know, if you're open to anything that comes. What are your thoughts on free will, John? Do you think that we're born into physical lives that we've previously chosen, and there's some sort of a script, or do we have the ability to change outcomes constantly?
Well, I mean, it appears, and even science tells us we don't have free will, doesn't it? But it appears we do have an amount of free will, doesn't it? It was very interesting when I made a documentary with Gary Schwartz a few years ago about a precognitive named Christopher Robinson, and he'd done a lot of experiments with Christopher about where the guy, he was having dreams in advance, and they would pick locations, and he would dream where they were going to go, and they'd, anyway, I won't bore you with all the details. But the reason that when you were talking about free will, what was interesting was this guy Christopher, and I've had precognitive dreams that I didn't really realize at the time because I was writing a journal and very obviously precognitive. But what was interesting that he said, when someone asked him, have you, because he was having dreams about plane crashes and terrorist disasters, you know, the police are arresting him in the UK because he phoned him up himself, had a dream. This is in the IRA days when there was a lot of terrorism in London back in the 80s and 70s. And he was saying, you know, there's a bomb going off in Leicester or something. Anyway, a bomb would go off in Leicester and they'd arrest him for it because he couldn't be in all these places. But what was very interesting that came out of making that program, apart from the fact these things did seem to happen to him on a regular basis, was he able to save anybody? And he said he was only ever able to save himself, unfortunately. So in other words, he could have a dream about, you hear about people having a dream about going on a plane, and they're going on a plane, and they don't go on the plane, and the plane crashes, that kind of thing. But he was never able to save anyone else. And I always thought that was interesting, in the sense that, so maybe we have free will to, I mean, it does appear we have free will, doesn't it? We can stop ourselves being run over by a car, or we can stop ourselves. So we do appear to have some kind of free will.
Yeah, I mean, there may very well be, you know, some framework that we're involved in, and, you know, when we decide, you know, to incarnate in this life, but, you know, with a lot of branches on it, and our free will, you know, may take us down many different paths, but I don't think anything is, certainly not everything is set in stone, at least I don't believe it is.
No, so, no, yeah. I mean, I, you know, who knows, again, you know, if you read about reincarnation, if you read about, you know, communications coming through back from the 1800s, 1900s, some people believe that reincarnation is just, you know, attachments. Other people believe that if you're in a low level, let's say when you died, you reincarnate, but you don't get to choose. And then some people believe, well, if you're a higher vibration, you do get to choose. There's all these different ideas, and I would be open. I wouldn't want to say anything but right, because that would be unreasonable. But I'm open to them, and I think the more you read about this, it's a bit like someone goes to Australia and you've never been there. If 10 people come back, they'll have an idea about. It'll tell you if their different experiences going to Australia, but you'll get an idea, even though you've never been, of what Australia might be like. So I don't think it's completely unreasonable. It's a bit like people with near-death experiences. If, you know, if 2,000 people have a near-death experience, and most of them record something, whatever it might be, it wouldn't be unreasonable to think that might be the way to go.
What do you think personally that people fear the most about death? I mean, is it the nothingness, or, I mean, certainly there's a fear, but.
Well, that's interesting you should say that, because when I have my event, let's call it, I was in my early 40s. So before then, I didn't really think about it too much, I certainly didn't believe anything happened afterwards. I certainly thought, well, I just thought that was it, and that was it. And that was quite comforting. I didn't mind that. I mean, to be honest, when I had this, after I had this bang on the head, it was a bit inconvenient. I didn't quite like how I felt at the beginning, because I was quite enjoying how I was before, you know. But what was very interesting, I thought, and relating to your question, was I started doing some voluntary work for a big organization here, a suicide line. And I worked for, I was a volunteer for 12 years, talking to people who are
suicidal on a weekly basis. And the one thing that struck me right at the beginning was people were calling up in distressed states, some of them for all different reasons. You know, some were terminally ill, some were just very depressed, some had suffered terrible bereavements, some were in jail, some were paedophiles, some were criminals. I mean, you name it, everybody, anybody. But the one thing, and the one thing that really struck me was that the people who were feeling suicidal, they weren't afraid of dying. They were afraid of, they weren't afraid of snuffing themselves out into nothingness. That surprised me. They weren't afraid of that. They were afraid about what if they do make the wrong decision, if you see what I mean. Well, maybe they, you know, maybe they have some in the back of their mind about the idea of hell and all this kind of thing, or religious thing. And they were more afraid of that than actually not existing. And I suppose, and maybe there's some logic in that. I mean, we go to sleep every night. We don't worry. We don't. Most of us don't wake. Go to sleep and worry about whether we're going to wake up or not.
Yeah. Well, so it is.
I don't know, but yeah.
Well, because when I think about that often too, I mean, because the very thing that most people fear, which is the nothingness, you know, to people who decide to take their own lives, that's the very thing that is appealing to them, is the nothingness, because they're in pain, you know, and you know, have a, you know, a mental illness that, you know, is pushing them in that direction. So, you know, that's something that always comes up, you know. I mean, to some people, nothingness is something, I mean, you know, to me, that was my biggest fear. You know, I was terribly fearful of just ceasing to exist without a trace, you know. But to others, I can understand, you know, they think it's some sort of solace.
That didn't bother me. I remember when I had a general anesthetic, and I remember sitting in the doctor's room, and I was looking out at the green grass, and this was and I had to have a general anesthetic, and you know, if you've ever had one, I don't know, but you're sort of sitting there, and you're very aware that some people have general anesthetics and don't wake up. And I remember thinking, well, if I don't wake up, it's okay. I was okay with it. And right. But nowadays I feel very, you know, I mean, before that I was, nowadays, I mean, you know, if you'd have asked me 20 years ago, if I thought, you know, let's say suicide, what, I think everybody do whatever they like to do. And of course, so people do whatever they like to do. And for me personally, I didn't see it was anything wrong. Not that I'm saying there's anything wrong, but certainly I wouldn't even consider it now because I don't think it would, I don't think I would benefit from it. Put it that
right.
way. I don't think there would be nothing. I think there would be something. I don't think it's some eternal damnation like they've said in certain religious books. But I don't think. I just my feeling is I don't think I would. I don't think anyone benefits from it.
So you obviously we mentioned you started a publishing company, you know, White Crow Books, and it's very unusual in the fact that virtually everything that you published has some sort of a spiritual theme to it. Is that some mission that you felt that you needed to go on? I mean, you still wanted to be active in business, but doing something to benefit mankind?
Well, I guess so. Maybe it was a bit more. Maybe it's a bit more. I don't know. Maybe it was, what did happen was I got very engrossed in it. Or probably like, I mean, I look at what you've done with the Forever Family Foundation. I got very engrossed in it, and I was thinking, why don't more people know about this? And I want to spread the word and all that sort of thing. At the same time, I had to make a living. I wasn't very wealthy or anything like that. I had a good business before, but you know, I was living on it, and I walked out of a career, which was a high paying career, and to nothing. And I thought, and I was reading a lot of these old books, because I'd become completely engrossed in, you know, life after death type books, old spiritualist books, near death experience, all that sort of thing. And I was reading them thinking, I could do better than this. So I just started. I was picking, there were lots of books that were going out of print because of, you know, had been out of print for years. And I just thought, I'm going to do something with this. I didn't know anything about publishing, and I didn't really have any interest in publishing, but I had an interest in the subject. And that is, And I guess that's why I do it, because I'm interested in this. I mean, it provides a living, but it was a lot easier to make money in the music business, to be honest, but it provides a living, and I like doing it. And it reminds me, funny enough, in the record business, there are a lot of, when we were there, we had quite a big, couple of big independent companies, one smaller one and one large one. But we used to, in that business, there were people who were in business putting out music, but there were also a lot of people who were music enthusiasts. Like you get, you know, a jazz enthusiast, and he or she would just be loving jazz music, and they basically started a little jazz label because it was a way to work with jazz and make a living. Do you see what I mean? I tell people now that I've become an enthusiast. You know, so what I tend to do is I tend to you know, with the digital printing and everything like that, you have a lot lower risk now to publish a book. So I kind of publish books that I'm interested in, really. I mean, hopefully they sell, but they're more about ones that I'm interested in. And I am interested in sort of spreading the word, so to speak.
Mm.
And hopefully some people benefit from them somewhere around
the world. Well, I'm sure that they do. I know we're running out of time, but I just wanted to mention two of the characters in the book, you know, Will and Matt. Matt has a deep inner knowledge, and they got into the discussion of the system of life and creation. And he said, we can't remember who or what created it unless we step out of it. So what do you think Matt meant by that?
Well, I think what Matt meant by that was if you view this as not our ultimate reality, which is what we're constantly told by religions and by, you know, and that we're here having an experience, and that we learn from our experiences, but we can't really know the nature of our true reality while we're in this. A bit like, you know, we're in our own movie, so to speak, and it's not until we step out. So I think what Matt was talking about, was saying that it's not until we've got out of our incarnations, let's say, that we can know, that we can not even know, we probably already know, but they'll remember the nature of our reality.
Mm. Well, excellent insight, and I think you're right. When we step out to this other realm, we could see all the patterns that we can't see here. We would like to thank you so much. We were talking with J.R. Archer and the novel, A Dog's View of Life, of Love, Life, and Death. We do have a link on our Amazon, an Amazon link to it on the website, and you could also check out the other works of White Crow Books. Thank you, John, so much for being with us, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Have a good evening.
We now ask the listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Fred Folger, Michael Tim, David Hayes, Glenna Irwin, Marianne Pierschka, Diane Archangel, Isabel Ginsberg, Vince Mattia, Lauren Ramnath, Rich LeBly, Helen Montalto, Cynthia Post, Evelyn Ingram, Tina Young, Donna Mello, Matt Mello, Veronica James, Alex Hanna, Catherine Pye, Jerry Deanna, Max Banken, Linda Ellis, Eddie Coons, Sandy Rabel, Ed O'Brien. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away,
and science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.